This is Masters of Dispute Resolution on podclips.io. Masters of Dispute Resolution is designed to provide those involved in the mediation process with the views and insights of the most experienced and accomplished mediators in the profession. We'll share the stories of conflict and lessons learned from mediating challenging and intriguing disputes. You'll hear stories about how conflict affected the lives of those involved in the conflict and how resolution of disputes through mediation provided them with the ability to move forward unburdened by an ongoing dispute. Through our discussions, you will gain insight in how to address and overcome difficult issues and achieve more satisfying results in mediation, whether you're a mediator, attorney, or have been or contemplate being involved in mediation. Your host is Len Levy, mediator and arbiter with ADR Services, Inc., a leading alternative dispute resolution provider. Len litigated complex cases for more than 30 years and has been a mediator since 1998, joining ADR Services on its panel of neutrals in 2008. He has been recognized as a super lawyer in alternative dispute resolution beginning in 2014. And now your host, Len Levy.
Thank you, Daryl. Welcome, everyone, and thank you for joining us for Season 5 of Masters of Dispute Resolution, a podcast which will add tools to your mediation toolbox. We are brought to you by ADR Services and our new sponsor, American Institute of Mediation. Now, in each episode, you're going to hear a story, and in this case, it is going to be a doozy, about a conflict, the impact that the conflict had on the lives of the parties involved, how resolution was reached, and lessons to be taken from that conflict and its resolution. Many of the details of the story you are about to hear have been modified to preserve the confidentiality of mediation while also conveying the essence of the conflict and its resolution. Now, joining me today is Steve Cerveris. Steve and I have been friends for, 25, 26 years, thereabouts, and I actually met Steve through being on the board of directors of the Southern California Mediation Association way back in the day. And Steve had transitioned at that point to a large degree, at least, after 15 years of his now 40-year legal career. He transitioned from being a litigator to being a mediator. And his background as a litigator certainly helps, but his immense skills and knowing how to help the parties resolve cases really shines with Steve. Steve has also been a member of the Los Angeles Superior Court Alternative Dispute Resolution Committee, actually through 2011, and is a member of the California State Bar's Committee on Alternative Dispute Resolution from 2005 to 2009, and was elected to serve as chair of that committee in 2009. Steve and I also share the fact that we both began actually at Loyola as adjuncts in 2009. And Steve spent 10 years teaching negotiations to third year students. He has amazing career achievements, various awards, Volunteer of the Year Award from the LA County Board of Supervisors and the Los Angeles County Dispute Resolution Program for his services as a volunteer mediator. He's been recognized as a California top neutral by the Los Angeles and San Francisco Daily Journal and recognized annually as a Southern California super lawyer in the field of alternative dispute resolution since 2006. And was recognized by his peers as in Best Lawyers of America. And he just keeps going on and on and on. I don't want to spend the rest of the podcast talking about Steve's achievements. I'd rather hear his story. So Steve, take it away.
Len, thank you. First of all, it's a pleasure to be here. This is my first podcast, so please be gentle.
Mazel tov.
I wanted to talk about a case that took place a number of years ago, but it's one that has stayed with me. And I'll just jump in and try to give you a pretty quick synopsis. There was a, and this is a tough one. There was a young teenage girl who was a church group leader with a church that I was not familiar with, but learned that it had sects throughout the United States, different districts throughout, and this was one local. And this young woman, teenage woman, was using the restroom at the church after teaching a youth group class. She found a 14-year-old girl sobbing uncontrollably on the floor of the bathroom. Needless to say, she was taken aback. She told me she sat down next to her, put her arm around her, and tried to console her, and just said, "You know, what's wrong? Are you okay? Can I help you?" And the girl was hesitant, but she was able to warm up to this woman pretty quickly. And she said that one of the pastors in the church had been touching her inappropriately. They proceeded to have a conversation, a little more detail. The girl was continuing to cry, and now the teenage girl who was trying to console her started to cry as well. And she revealed during this conversation, when she realized which pastor this young woman was talking about, that she too had been molested. And so they bonded in a very tearful discussion. And then that's what began. That's what led to an uncovering of a number of other molestation victims, the youngest being 11 years of age, going up to age 17, all by the same minister. It turns out that the minister pastor was a close relative of another one of the church elders in this organization. And so by the time this all came to light and came to mediation, the pastor had already been prosecuted criminally. I never really knew the details of that. I don't know if there was a plea arrangement or if a trial took place. I think it was a plea arrangement because it was a pretty strong criminal case. And so it ended up in the civil world. And what came to me was approximately 7 or 8 young women. By that point, they were all, some of them in their early 20s, some of them in their late teens. And these were not all of the victims of this perpetrator. These were just the ones that were brave enough to step forward and were taking this case on in a civil fashion. And that's what brought them to me.
Steve, what information did you have about the, not necessarily the incident, but the effect that the incident was having on the lives of the victims?
Well, that's the both fascinating and really upsetting part of this story, is that the more I learned after talking to some of these women during some of these private sessions and early on in the mediation, some of them went to their parents and discussed this, the ones that started to come forward. And some of the parents didn't believe them. This was a very tight-knit church, and the community was such that even some of their own parents said, "No, that's not happening." What I learned from the girls, the most insidious part of this saga, was that the pastor involved with all of them used the same MO to groom these extremely young women, and did so in a way using religion, using God, using their devotion to the church, and said that the way that they could truly show their love for God and devotion to the church was through him. He was going to be that vehicle, but that these were special relationships that they were in no way to share or discuss with anyone. I mean, it was the perfect path I had seen, never quite to this degree, in terms of grooming this type of predatory behavior. And it was consistent between a number of these young women. And that took the wind out of my sails. Just realizing that somebody would literally use this power, but something so powerful, you know, is people's religious faith, to say, you know, you need to succumb to me, to increase your position in the church, your position in God's eyes, and then to have some of the parents of these young women deny that it happened. And so, you know, they came to me with this tremendous burden. And some of them were just psychologically damaged for life. Some of the stronger ones, the ones that were kind of leading the charge and the mediation, I think had already been through some therapy and were still just starting to work their way through what had happened.
Right. And Steve, the difficulty with these cases, and I've done some child molestation cases, the most prominent one being involving a youth sports league. But the thing that parents do not apparently understand at times is that this is a question of power being exerted over their child and by someone who is trusted, who is betraying a trust, and that the profound effect on the actual lives of these victims. For example, not being believed by your parents. How did that come to light? Did you have interviews with each of them or with their attorney? I'm talking pre-mediation now.
Well, as I said, I chose not to have, prior to the day of the mediation, these discussions because I needed to have them in person. These were not discussions I felt I could do effectually on the phone. But I did have, you know, before, during the mediation, have, again, I wouldn't call them interviews per se. I had private discussions initially with counsel and a small group of the women, and then subsequently with the women separately. I wanted to make them as comfortable as I possibly could under these horrific circumstances. And so that's where I just let them tell me as much or as little as they were comfortable sharing, you know, how they had experienced this. And as I said, when the one person said, you know, my mom didn't believe me, that's the one that just set me back. Right. I you try to put yourself in that kind of a situation. But then it started to make sense when I heard how this pastor, again, was using his power, as you suggest, an influence. These parents, who were also devout members of this church, they were in denial. They couldn't believe that this church that they had given themselves up to, you know, would have a member who would do this to their child. And so, you know, they took the unfortunate position that their child was just incorrect, was lying, was making this up. And that just compounded, as you can imagine, you know, what these young women were experiencing, and most of whom, you know, said nothing because they were following the directive of this pastor. You know, I can't say anything. I'm doing God's work.
And Steve, one of the concerns that we always have as a mediator is that we have to establish trust as mediators for essentially everyone who's participating in that mediation. And in these instances, as a priority, the victims. So you have someone who is coming to you to say, okay, help me. Their level of trust is going to be a challenge.
It's trust of, at times, their own parents. It's trust of clergy. It's trust of men. Again, I'm you know, at the time I was somewhat of a middle-aged man dealing with these horrific stories with these young women. I'm now an old man, but you know, I approached it, you know, without really being able to understand what they had experienced. And that gets into what I really researched on my own beforehand, which was the important distinction between sympathy and empathy.
Well, we're going to get to those distinctions and other things as we continue. But right now we're going to take a break. You're listening to Masters of Dispute Resolution. Our guest is Steve Cerveris, and we're chatting about the effects of child molestation.
Masters of Dispute Resolution would like to thank ADR Services Incorporated, your partner in resolution, and its founder, Lucy Barron, for supporting this podcast. ADR Services is one of the leading providers of alternative dispute resolution in California, leveraging technology to drive resolution. ADR Services is committed to dynamism in the face of growing client need and an ever-evolving legal climate. Now operating offices in all major legal markets of California, ADR Services provides unparalleled in-person and remote resolution services through its exclusive panel, comprised of more than 130 of the most distinguished and talented neutrals across the state, capable of handling challenging and complex mediations, arbitration, and other procedures in every field of law. When you seek the services of a neutral and you want results and satisfied clients, contact ADR Services, www.adrservices.com.
Welcome back to Masters of Dispute Resolution. I'm Len Levy, and my guest is Steve Cerveris, who was talking about a child molestation case. We are talking about that case and the mediation of that case. And you drew a distinction between sympathy and empathy, I think, as we broke. And do you want to expand on that just a little bit and how that apply here?
Sure. I mean, I always thought I had an idea, but going into this mediation, I wanted to try to prepare myself emotionally as best I could. And I thought that was an important distinction. And, you know, what I came to learn and realize, sympathy is when you feel something for someone else. Empathy is when you feel something with someone else. And that was the struggle for me. You know, how do I, at that point in time, empathize with these young women who had experienced something that I had never experienced? I'd mediated other clergy abuse cases and molestation cases, but not quite of this magnitude. And so that was, it was something I really tried to get my head around. And again, I had many private discussions with these young women, with initially with their attorneys, and just by listening, which is, you know, often easier said than done. But in this case, these stories were just so horrific that I felt compelled to be as patient and to listen as carefully as I could, and that put me in a better place. I mean, I was able to feel with them because they were so specific in their descriptions about how, you know, how this had all taken place.
It would seem to me also it put them in a better place, being able to tell the story and tell the story to someone who is there to help them. Must have had a, well, it was, it sounds like an absolutely necessary effect, necessary thing to do, and relates to your being, they're being able to trust you.
Trust, obviously a huge issue in a situation where these young women had very little left. And so, you know, I did my best within the time frame of this mediation to, again, to listen, to try to, you know, explain, you know, I have no idea what you personally experienced, but, you know, I need you to help me understand. And they did. And it was, they said, that was the most moving part of the process. And I think it was. I think there was some catharsis with these women. And again, in our process, as you know, we try to create a very comfortable and safe atmosphere to have these discussions. You know, I have an office that's very conducive for that. You know, we have a lot of different smaller breakout rooms. And I would, you know, bring the lawyer and one plaintiff at a time in to sit down and just have a discussion where nobody else was listening, nobody else was watching. You know, they were not being asked specific questions other than follow-up questions by me. It's like, just, you know, tell me what happened. Tell me how it made you feel. Tell me, you know, what your goal is today in this mediation, you know, after explaining what the process was and what we were hopefully going to do. And as you know, two main facets to all of these cases. There's always a monetary component, but unlike, you know, a lot of other cases we do, there was a huge, and in my opinion, much more important non-monetary component.
The non-monetary component, we're going to get through into that as we talk about the mediation. But the day of the mediation, and was it set up on one day? It kind of give me a picture here.
Yeah, it's. I got the impression that they did not want to drag this out, which kind of led me to believe that the plaintiff's lawyer, you know, didn't want to ruminate over this too long. And so we did it all in a day. And not all of the plaintiffs took me up on my offer to have a private discussion, to sit down and talk. Some of them, some of the younger ones, were more reticent to discussed anything, let alone the specific details. Others were very forthcoming. And so, again, I spoke with them together initially and just said, you know, how can I make this, you know, easier? How can I make this comfortable? And you know, we decided on having these, you know, separate sessions with, again, lawyer present and the plaintiff separately, so they felt as comfortable as they could.
And on the defense side, if we're going to get any case settled, you need people on the defense side who are attuned to it and are following along in the, and participating in the process rather than getting reports. So how did you handle the defense end?
So we never had a traditional joint session in that way where we brought everyone together in the same room. You know, we discussed all possibilities. That was not an option. So I had discussions, and I had worked with the defense attorneys before. They specialized in these types of cases. So these were issues they were familiar with. They understood the sensitivity of it. Again, we had the usual insurance issues with multiple different insurance policies. We had the usual, you know, procedural concerns about, you know, where's the money going to come from and how will it be allocated and so on. But it was not the most significant part of the day. And the defense lawyers understood my need and desire to give these young women an opportunity to have these private, separate discussions. They knew the allegations. There had been pleadings that are already out there. Defense lawyers were a material part of this because I think they were aware of what needed to be done to try to get this discussion moving forward and for me to create a safer, you know, more comfortable atmosphere for these women.
The decision makers on, at least on the non-monetary side, and perhaps on the monetary side, it seems would have to include the church elders, those in power. It sounds like, as in a lot of these cases, you're not simply relying on insurance companies to make decisions here.
No, absolutely. And again, primarily with the non-monetary issues. And that was the other dynamic of this case, is that I had a series of church elders, one of whom was a very close relation to the pastor who was incarcerated at the time of the mediation. And that was also a challenge. Again, thankfully, the other elders were helpful, I think, in that regard. Because again, as I'm sure you'll get me to shortly, you know, we did have some form of a joint session that we fashioned together by sitting down and just gathering information from everybody, what, you know, what could work. And when we finally agreed on a methodology, you know, I then started the usual coaching, just explaining, you know, here's how we're going to try to work this. And, you know, what will you be comfortable with discussing? How, you know, we just set up the format, and then that ultimately led in. But yes, in terms of the non-monetary issues, the church elders were absolutely essential. And again, they too, recognizing the severity of this situation, I think approached the mediation, you know, with a high degree of sensitivity, appropriately so. You know, it wasn't the typical mediation. This wasn't a case where we were going to fight over liability. Did this happen? Even the degree to which it had happened, it was a very different mediation than I am used to.
Okay, so you have in the same at the same time, so to speak, in your office, your offices. If you haven't seen Steve's office, it's absolutely amazing how it's been built out and conducive to being a safe place for people. And the joint session that you've described was a planning session in terms of how we're going to approach it. It was not a substantive session, just exchanging numbers or exchanging anything substantive there. So you get into the idea of you've got all of these church elders there. You have insurance representatives there, I take it.
Yes.
And those, and so you've lined things up to be able to take advantage of and to the extent that you even know, you never know in a mediation, whether something else is going to be needed externally. But you've lined things up so that people know what to expect, right? Is that that's was your goal initially?
Yes, and I did that through, again, for the most part, we were not all together. I would have a discussion with the defense counsel, the insurance reps, and the church elders about, again, putting together a methodology for proceeding throughout the day. And then one with plaintiff's counsel and his clients as well. So okay, two separate discussions, and I tried to create an amalgam of these different suggestions into how best to approach this. And we were able to work through that pretty quickly.
Well, and that speaks to your skill in dealing with multi-party negotiations. This is a skill that's born of a lot of experience and a lot of sometimes things don't work and sometimes they do.
A lot of trial and error. And again, I was, you know, I'm sure you've heard this before. People say, you know, defense lawyers, plaintiffs, counsel to the mediator, you know, we don't want to tell you how to do your job, Steve. I always stop them and say, please tell me how to do my job. I said, you know, I certainly bring some experience to the table, but, you know, I welcome yours. We have to work on this together, especially in a case like this. That doesn't happen in most of my cases. But on this day, it was going to require collaboration. And thankfully, we were able to do that.
And just to be clear for our audience, all of the plaintiffs, all of the victims were represented by a single counsel, correct?
Yes.
Did the fact that they were represented by a single counsel help or hurt the process? For example, sometimes there are issues of insurance coverage in terms of not in terms of whether something is covered necessarily, but in terms of allocation of the proceeds. These policies do not have open-ended limits. And so was there anything there that you needed to address in terms of available money, things of that nature? Those types of issues come up.
There were some, you know, there's always a monetary component, as I said, but it was more, you know, we were discussing, there was a breakdown in terms of certain amounts going to certain plaintiffs, because there were some that had been victims for longer periods of time, for instance. Again, some of the younger ones, you know, they approached that differently than they did the older ones. And so there were, you know, a lot of nuances. But I think the fact that there was only one attorney was helpful, in my opinion. If I had, you know, 7 or 8 different plaintiffs' lawyers there all vying for their client, and you know, then the allocation issues, I think, would have been much greater. And that really was not a problem in this case. And I think that's in part because it was a very good plaintiff's lawyer who, and I had discussed that with him, had pretty much worked out. That's one of my questions, you know, how are we going to deal with the allocation issues? Is that a problem? Is it something I need to be aware of? And I was assured pretty early on that that was not going to be a concern. And it didn't turn out to be. So that was helpful.
Good. Also, did the plaintiffs want to confront? Did any of the plaintiffs want to confront the elders?
I wouldn't use the word confront, but to have an opportunity to talk to them. Yes, not all of them, but quite a few.
Okay. And setting up those sessions, did that pose any particular problem that we needed to, or that you needed to overcome?
Yes, quite a few.
Well, I'll tell you what, then we're going to take a break. I'm Len Levy. I'm on Masters of Dispute Resolution, having a wonderful conversation with my friend and colleague, Steve Cerveris. We'll be back.
We hope you're enjoying another fascinating episode of Masters of Dispute Resolution. Has the show ever made you think about becoming a mediator or doing the work these experts are discussing? Are you thinking about it now? Imagine a career where you're working to help people in conflict find win-win solutions. The sense of purpose you'll feel can easily be heard in the voices of our guests on the show and its host, expert mediator Len Levy. Or maybe you're a mediator already and you're looking to add your toolbox and pull off some of the brilliant and out-of-the-box solutions these guests are talking about. That's where we come in. We're the American Institute of Mediation. We train mediators of all levels. We're the place you want to come to learn the basics of mediation or to raise your game in the field. Our slogan is world-class training for the complete mediator, because we feature the world's best mediation trainers, and we prepare you for all aspects of being a mediator in all kinds of settings. Find us at AmericanInstituteOfMediation.com and browse our selection of courses for streaming on demand, or call us at 310-593-9906. Watch our courses at your convenience, at your desk, on a plane, or in bed in your jammies. Then we'll see you in the mediation world soon.
Welcome back to Masters of Dispute Resolution, and this is Len Levy speaking with Steve Cerveris about a child molestation case and its mediation. So, Steve, when we broke, we were talking about there were some difficulties that needed to be overcome in order to reach resolution of this case. Would you want to expand on that?
Sure. I got the impression from the plaintiff's counsel that not all, but some of these young women did want to have an opportunity to talk to the church elders to, in their own words, explain what had happened. So the first thing I had to do, and this came again through my private discussions with the plaintiff's lawyer and these women on an individual basis. So it would just be the three of us in a small breakout room. As I said, it became apparent that some of them were sadly so badly damaged that they had internalized this, and they weren't terribly communicative. The last thing in the world they would be comfortable with is sitting in a room facing these people and having a discussion. So we kind of had to weed them out and explain, here's how we're going to do this. You don't have to sit down and talk to anybody. But the other ones were pretty vehement about wanting to do so. So then the question became, how are we going to structure these sessions? As I mentioned, one of the church elders was a very close relation to the pastor who was incarcerated for engaging in this molestation. And thankfully, I was able to convince the group of church elders that it probably would not be the best idea to have that elder sit down. I wanted to have literally about two, maybe three at most, of the elders. I wanted to keep it small, again, to create a sense of safety. And then it was a question of, what do we discuss in there? What do you want to talk about? What are you comfortable and willing to? The allegations had been out there because of the criminal case. And so we really didn't have to get into the more, graphic details of what happened. But like I said, it's as egregious as you can imagine. That's what some of these young women suffered. And so, some of them did talk a little bit about that. But again, we structured how this was going to work because I wanted these women to know going into this, what was expected of them, which I said, nothing. I said, you're going to go in and essentially dictate what you want to say, what you want to discuss.
And what did they, without getting into great detail, but what is it that they needed from the church elders in terms of getting things aired?
Well, I think, again, some of these women had matured and had thankfully had some counseling and were trying to work through this themselves. But again, where most of this initiated was through educational programs that the church had set up. Some of these women, as I said, were counselors, and they worked with some of these other younger children. And so the pastor would have opportunities, having separate meetings and discussions, but just the way the church was physically set up, there were unfortunately plenty of opportunities for him to be alone with these women. They had no safeguards in place. And that was something that came out through these stories. And part of my job was to offer some suggestions and say, if they had had, a requirement that there always be, one woman and one man in these classes and at all times with these children, whether they're larger or smaller groups, do you think that would have helped? Would that have possibly prevented? And so, through question and answer, some of these ideas started to develop. And then in these joint sessions, these small joint sessions with, there was no lawyer. I was able to, another key part of this, the sign of a phenomenal plaintiff's lawyer and defense lawyer, that will relinquish control to a mediator and allow me to have these private sessions, because I was mainly wanting to be a fly on the wall. I just, again, I wanted these young women to feel comfortable. I wanted the church elders who knew what was coming, and I coached them. This wasn't an inquisition. It wasn't going to be a deposition. This is an opportunity to let these young women talk. And that's how it unfolded.
You just used the phrase of the attorneys being willing to relinquish control to the mediator. It seems, in your telling here, at least it seems to me, they were also relinquishing control to their client, which is something that attorneys are sometimes loath to do.
Absolutely. That
makes them very uncomfortable. In this particular case, though, they were experienced enough to know what might happen during those sessions. Were the sessions that those joint sessions with the couple of elders and you observing the victim talking, were those an important key to reaching a non-monetary settlement?
Absolutely. I think it was essential. I don't think it would have happened without it. And again, you know, when I'm talking about attorneys relinquishing control, you know, we set up very specific safeguards for these sessions. You know, I said the elders were, you know, they were not going to be asking questions. They, you know, we had conversation, but it wasn't going to be an inquisition. So I just tried to allay the concerns of the lawyers and say, you know, they're not going to be digging for information. They're not going to be using this if we can't settle to move forward with litigation. These are going to be in relatively, you know, short sessions. And so, like I said, it was wouldn't have happened had the lawyers, in my view, not provided that opportunity, because I wanted as few people in these rooms as possible to make it less intimidating for these women who were willing to stand up and say, you know, here's what happened. Here's, you know, how it happened, when it happened. And that's what led to coming up with some suggestions and solutions about what safeguards could be implemented in the church to try to prevent something like this from happening again.
And you know, what you're illustrating here, it seems to me, is the difference between settling a lawsuit and resolving a conflict. And so often the higher purpose of resolving a conflict to essentially answer the inner needs of the client are put to the wayside. So in this case, it seems like there was a recognition that there, if there was going to be any healing, this was going to have to take place.
Yes, absolutely. As I said, the damage had been done. The hope was that the financial component might be instrumental in helping some of these women heal, hopefully all of them, but at least getting some help. But the other thing was, you know, the sense of empowerment that I think came to these women who felt so helpless, you know, were subjected to silence, you know, couldn't discuss this with anyone for a long period of time. Had it not been for the one woman who finally came forward, and I think she just seeing this young 14-year-old girl sobbing on the floor of the bathroom, she realized, my God, I didn't say anything, and now look what's happened, and found out that it had been happening to others. And you know, just incredibly, you know, courageous woman to come forward, just confronting all of these things. And again, layer upon layer of, you know, religion on top of this. You know, you're doing this for God. You're showing your devotion. It was just, you know, just layer upon layer.
So as far as the solutions go, what types of solutions were applied that through the mediation process?
Well, first of all, something that now has become much more common, and I don't think at this time, and I don't know to what degree it was common within religious organizations, was training across the board. You know, not just the usual sexual harassment type training, but something more specific. And And that was one of a number of things that, again, these young women were suggesting and became a part of the non-monetary discussion of how can we resolve this dispute. Part of that was training. And what was, I think, another crucial piece of the puzzle was this was one small church in Southern California. As I mentioned, I hadn't heard of, wasn't familiar with this church, but there were different sects of this church throughout the country, different districts. It was quite a prolific church. What was implemented at that mediation was to take place throughout the country. So these young women weren't just trying to safeguard, you know, parishioners at this local church, but nationwide, and something that the church elders, you know, were more than willing to adopt as one of the facets of resolving this dispute.
So the institutional changes, you know, how many mediations have any of us had where institutional change can and does take place?
Not as many as I would like.
Right. So as far as takeaways for attorneys, let's start those who might be involved in, it doesn't necessarily have to be a child molestation case, but are there any universal lessons that you would want our audience to know about?
Well, one of the themes I mentioned, and you may not have used the best terminology when I talk about relinquishing control. You know, lawyers often talk about client control. It's an awful misnomer, yeah. But it comes up quite a bit. Here, to me, it's more about courage. I've worked with many lawyers who have had the courage when I have said, I really think a way through this would be to allow me to sit down, knowing that I'm not there to try to dictate or direct the discussion. I'm just trying to facilitate communication between people, and knowing that that could blow up and end the day. And I've had that happen before. But that would be one, you know, thought that I would impart to lawyers, is to say, just, you know, look at this, look at the facts of the case, look at the personalities involved and what might be beneficial. And if possible, if the mediator is suggesting that you consider that type of a get together, where they're asking the lawyers to not be there, because as you know, it changes the dynamic tremendously. Again, we make suggestions, and I think for lawyers to be open to that, and this is, you know, partnership disputes, different things where they're continuing relationships, where that dialogue is important. I think that would be an important takeaway. Just be aware of that as a possibility and be open to it and courageous enough to allow, and trusting enough to allow that discussion to take place without you being there as an advocate.
Right. Well, you know, the difficult circumstances that presented themselves for you in this was a multi-layered conflict with psychological issues, insurance issues, all of that. You had a plan, at least a plan that presented alternatives. And the one, at least a takeaway that I'm hearing, is that we have to, as mediators, put in the work to see what the parties truly need and to construct those types of procedures in any particular mediation that seem to work or may not work, and at which point we reassess, reevaluate.
And if you can do that with the help of the lawyers, sometimes the insurance representatives, and the parties involved, I think coming together can be instrumental in arriving at the best method and hopefully a lasting resolution.
Well, Steve, unfortunately, we're out of time because, I mean, we could talk for hours on this. This is absolutely an incredible story, a great deal of practical takeaways for for everyone to use and lessons to be learned for mediators and attorneys alike. So I thank you for the conversation, and I hope you'll consider coming back again. We'll work this out, huh?
I would be happy to. You got me through my first podcast painlessly. I appreciate that. You're a great host.
Well, thank you for that. Steve, as we wrap up, how can listeners contact you to learn more about your practice and utilizing your mediation services?
The best way, Len, is probably through my website, which is tricky because no one can pronounce or spell my last name. It's Cerveris, and it's spelled C-E-R-V-E-R-I-S. My website is cerverismediation.com. And that will have contact information about calendaring, scheduling, and a host of other information just about kind of cases I mediate, and resumes and pictures of our wonderful office as well.
Thank you, Daryl Wayne, my engineer and producer. And I'm your host, Len Levy, and this is Masters of Dispute Resolution on podclips.io, powered by Infogen Labs, Inc. I hope you will continue to enjoy the stories we bring you, and in the meantime, stay well, keep listening, and remember, peace of mind is enhanced when conflicts are resolved.
If you wish to contact Len Levy, you can reach him through his email at lslevy@adrservices.com, through Len's website, lenlevymediate.com, telephone him at 818-903-5562, or contact his case manager at ADR Services, 213-683-1600.